This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Kwikwetlem peoples.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is April 19th, 2024.
I'm Scott Blondeville.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we have a federal budget to dig into. Yes, this is one of those years they didn't put it off. So remember that year we just didn't have a budget?
Yeah, although that was 2020. I'm willing to give them a little slack on that.
And then 2021's budget was very late, too. Anyway, we're back to normal budgeting in the federal government department, which is mid-April. And to help us with our podcast budget, go to patreon.com/politicoast and chip in a few bucks. Before we jump into the federal budget, which will eat up the majority of today's hour, here in BC, we have a little bit of news as MLA Mike DeYoung is leaving the BC United Party, and he has announced that he wants to run for the federal Conservatives in the upcoming election. This is like worst kept secret.
Yeah. We'd known for a while. He'd already announced he wasn't going to be seeking re-election as an MLA. This has been the speculation for months now. I'm pretty sure he's been talked about as potential MP for that riding for years as well. But yeah, finally happening. Like I said, not a well kept secret. Surprising. Literally no one.
We also have the news that, you know, this is another conservative this is another BC United MLA who's not running again. It's not surprising for Mike DeYoung. He's been around for a while, but, you know, that's the 10th.
One of the first liberals ever elected.
The 10th MLA from their party to announce they are not running again. They also lost Rustad and Bandman from their caucus. So it's quite the pain they'll be going into this election with. Nevertheless,
well, I mean, if the polls are any indication, they're going to be losing a lot more than 10 MLAs.
Yeah, people can read. What's very funny, though, is BC Proud, I don't know exactly what they are anymore, but the vocal part of one element of the conservative.
The social media organization. Yeah. I think it's probably about as pure a description as I can come up with.
They decided to dunk on him for being a former liberal going to the conservatives, and it kind of shows how the movement has shifted to the point where they don't want Mike DeYoung to join the federal conservatives.
Which is wild, because as finance minister, he was famously tight when it came to spending money, which, if anything, he didn't endear them to the federal conservatives.
But I guess he wasn't socially conservative enough for them? I don't know.
Also, the guy doesn't use email, so maybe not exactly a great fit with the social media-focused current version of the Conservative Party.
In any case, it'll be interesting to see if he wins the nomination out in Abbotsford, if there is a race for it.
I'm sure he will.
And how he does in the federal election. That seems like a pretty safe seat for the federal Conservatives.
I mean, at this point, there's some polling projections where I've seen places like Vancouver Centre going Conservative, just based on the absolute blowout poll numbers they have right now. So, yeah, Abbotsford, safe conservative seat. I think we can pretty much call it now.
But to try to save their furniture, the Liberals have introduced the fairness for everything. Excuse me.
That was a great Freudian slip there.
The Liberals have introduced the fairness for every generation budget 2024. This is the budget targeting millennials and Generation Z. Who are referenced many, many times. I don't even think Gen X got a shout out in this budget. Sorry
Which
to them.
Which is fitting for Gen X.
But this
also wild that the current Prime Minister, Gen Xer,
he's doing fine, other than poll-wise. He has a house.
I mean, he's going to be out of a job soon, but other than that.
So, this budget brings in a waft of new spending, significant amounts, that kind of disappears against the comparisons it shows on the 2023 federal fall economic statement. So budget deficits are sitting around $40 billion a year, and they're projecting they go down to $20 billion a year in the next 5 years, which is overall only a couple billion more than they had been predicted in the fall. Nevertheless, as we've talked about the last couple weeks through all the pre-budget announcements on housing and the food program, there's a lot of new spending in here. And it's impressive that they managed to, with one tax measure and some shifting funds around and downsizing the public service a tiny bit, keep the numbers in line.
I mean, that tax measure is not going to account for it alone. The big headline tax measures, they're changing some rules around the capital gains. Over the next 5 years, that's going to be bringing in like 18, 19 billion-ish on this. So it doesn't even cover, you know, spread that out over 5 years. It's not even close to covering off the decrease in the deficit.
That's a good amount of money, though. Looking at,
it's not nothing, no. But it's, you know, $5 billion a year is not the sort of thing that changes a nearly a $500 billion budget.
No. Notable in here as well, I think they are predicting a decent economic growth that will help cancel that, because one of the tricks of being the federal government and not a household is you can grow the economy and then you don't act and you just raise more tax revenues by having more taxpayers and wealthier taxpayers. So those are the kind of two tricks they're using. They are predicting, importantly, the federal debt to GDP ratio, which is sitting around 41% right now, to decline to about 39% over these 5 years, all of which keeps us within relatively recent good amounts on public debt charges, even with higher interest rates. This is a budget that conservatives will scream about for high spending and all of that, but I saw a number of economists looking at this and going, yeah, they're spending more, but the projections in here aren't bad. Like, they could be tighter if you were a fiscal hawk, but there is important spending that they can justify. So it's not a the sky is falling budget.
No, but on the same time, it doesn't really cover a lot of the like key problems we've been dealing with, particularly on the economy. The thing I was really curious about before this started was, you know, what was going to be the thing they're going to be looking at to really drive up productivity and per capita GDP rather than total GDP, because yeah, we've had great total GDP growth, but it's almost been entirely swamped by the population growth. And, you know, total GDP is important for stuff like public debt charges. And, you know, if you want a sizable military or like have influence globally on whatnot, like those total numbers, pretty important there. On the, is everyone actually better off and are we like more prosperous as a country? That's really where the per capita GDP comes in, and that is in large part downstream of productivity growth, and the budget's a little lacking on that front. So, I mean, yeah, top line numbers seem fine, but it's also obscuring some of the larger structural problems in the country's economy.
I think the way they're trying to address that is indirectly through a multitude of measures here that seem all over the place from afar, but I think their tying theme of like generational fairness is what threads housing and science investments and a few of the other elements together to try to say, look, if we can make people's lives more affordable, they will have more money in the pocket to spend. And if, you know, if we can bring housing costs down, if we can bring dental and childcare costs down, if we can give grad students some more money after decades of being yelled at to give grad students more money because they don't get much money, that can translate in many ways. So
yeah, although like that has been a fairly, I think, consistent philosophical underpinning of the Trudeau government's approach since they got elected in 2015, and like I was just talking about, it hasn't really seemed to have really shown up. At this point, nearly a decade on, per capita GDP hasn't really grown that much. We've kind of had a bit of a lost decade, and I don't think that can be, you know, entirely laid at the feet of the Trudeau government, but it's also, I think, far from clear that that, like, underlying philosophical perspective that, hey, if we focus on the equity side of it, the growth side will take care of itself, that hasn't really followed through, and we haven't really seen that in the past, well, 8 and a bit years.
Let's talk about what is in here in terms of spending. housing. We talked a lot about in the past couple episodes about the housing announcements that have already been done around the billions going for the apartment loan construction program, the Canada Housing Infrastructure Fund to get cities to sign on to federal density targets, more money for Housing Accelerator Fund, and all of that. All of that just before the budget was packaged into a Canada Housing Plan. That also included a few new measures that are also all in the budget. So there's now like one document containing everything that Sean Fraser wants to do. And good for him. He is carrying this government on his back. Hasn't gotten tired yet. What's kind of new that I spotted in the housing stuff in this budget is a real big emphasis on land, on taking public land and making houses on it. So there's going to be an effort to launch a public land bank by this fall. They're going to bring in legislation to facilitate the acquisition and use of public land for homes. Some of that will be working with other orders of government. They're going to have Canada Lands Company work to cut approval times to build affordable housing. And they're going to have $500 million to buy more public land. It says from other levels of government to spur sustainable mixed market housing.
Why from other levels of government?
Yeah, that part confused me a little bit.
It's not like BC wouldn't be using the lands that made sense for public housing for public housing. Maybe to like get Ontario or Saskatchewan or something to, you know, take a little bit of this to help, you know, cover off 1 year's budget or something. But like the amounts transferred are going to be so small. It's like even that doesn't really change their top line numbers. And at that point, like, they're just going to, particularly Alberta, Saskatchewan, just jealously guard their own prerogatives on that. So what's the point, I guess?
You did see that Alberta introduced a bill recently to ban subsidiary agencies and local governments from signing deals with the feds unless they get provincial sign-off, which is wildly petty territory marking.
I mean, they're basically following Quebec's footsteps on that.
But possibly so worse.
Hardly the first government in Canada to do that. And the Alberta separatist is too strong a word, but more autonomy-focused politicians have been taking notes from Quebec and are definitely enacting that. I thought that had sounded familiar. Yeah, they did announce this back in November of last year. Nothing really new there. I mean, some of the numbers may be slightly different. I've gone line by line and compared them. But yeah, it's more, I think, a case of emphasizing rather than brand new policy here.
Yeah, they did. Some specific properties that they've unlocked for some houses, like 800 units across five. But it gives examples, and you know, they flagged like Canada Post locations in small towns or suburbs across Canada that they might unlock.
Yeah, there's an armory in Vernon. Yeah. I think I saw on there, and I mean, sure, but it's not like there's huge amounts of unused federal land in the major cities where the housing crisis is most acute.
But I mean, that was Pierre Poilievre's, one of his platform was to audit the federal land holdings and try and make as much of it available for sale to build housing. And here the federal government is saying, we're going to do that, but we're not going to sell the land off. We're going to develop it ourselves or lease it to nonprofits at low to no rate, basically. And in either case, we get housing on public lands. In terms of new measures, they are looking at possibly taxing vacant residential land. They're going to consult on that first, and they're also going to look to restrict the purchase of existing single-family homes by large corporate investors. Two measures that are more like marginal, I think, and deal with some of the, like, why aren't you doing this kind of criticism.
Yeah, the loudest, dumbest voices on, like, social media on those, mostly. Particularly the latter on that case.
I did see there were some weird stories from the States where, like, because of the housing crash, I think a lot of single family homes came for sale cheap and corporate investors were buying up like whole neighborhoods. And that became like a very specific problem that I think we're having.
Yeah. I mean, a bunch of investors did buy up like immediately following the mortgage crisis. some of the defaulted properties on that. That was more than a decade ago. The current concern is that, yeah, some companies like, let's say, I think BlackRock and a few others are buying these up. If you actually read their mandatory disclosure statements that the SEC and other regulators require them to file, you look in there, they basically say, yeah, we're doing this because the housing supply is so scarce. It's just going to drive up the value of these assets higher. Like, it's all downstream of the housing scarcity. This doesn't really contribute to it in and of itself. It just changes the ownership around a bit. Like, it's ultimately not the case. It's going to be causing housing to be more expensive, but people get really weird about it, particularly because large corporate investors own a whole lot of apartments and nobody seems to mind in that case. It's this weird thing where the single-family homes get this undue cultural reverence and people get very weird about them when it comes to investors on them. And, like, keep in mind, single-family houses do not make a lot of sense as a thing for large investors to really get into most of the time in normal housing markets, because it's a single property that you have to put all the management costs of a single property. You can't spread it out over multiple tenants the way you can, say, in a large apartment complex. Yet none of the economies of scale that large corporate investors usually look for when it comes to housing investment. So it is entirely the case that the only reason why large corporate investors are even looking at this stuff is because the general market conditions actually offset all of the problems that they would normally encounter by it.
Some
anyway, fix the housing crisis and you don't have to worry about this.
Thankfully, version. Like, you know, these two measures aren't on their own. If they were, this would not be a housing plan, but there's lots of other stuff in here. Like, they're going to ask the natural resources, the National Research Council, to consult on point block access, single egress designs, and streamlining inspections. Basically, the nerdiest parts of housing policy that can actually make a difference, like simplifying how we build low-rise apartments by not requiring two staircases and things like that, can really
help. They handle the National Building Code, which is why they'd be
that's why they're
that.
In there. Okay.
Yes. So the various provincial codes are often based off the use the National Building Code as a template.
And this is another following DC.
Circling back to the single family home thing. The one thing I'm a little concerned about, and this would definitely be a devil in the details, is it going to make land assemblies harder for the very needed developments on that? How you structure that program is going to be very important, and I could see if they get some detail wrong, which, particularly with this government, is entirely possible. It could really harm a lot of their overall work on.
They want to play around with mortgages. They are going to change mortgage rules to encourage densification by enabling homeowners to add more units. I guess basically just make it a little bit easier that if I wanted to remortgage my house to add multiplex units on, the banks would be more sympathetic to that. It's unclear exactly how you make that work, but I guess you just beg the banks really nicely. One of the favorite things this government likes to do is promise to just like consult with industry on doing things better. And sometimes they've actually gotten, you know, ground with it. I'll give them credit. And they're also going to open up 30-year insured mortgages for first-time homebuyers purchasing newly constructed homes.
Okay. This seems weirdly narrowly targeted.
Right? I mean, I'll admit I have a 30-year mortgage, but only because we had a significant enough down payment that we didn't have to limit ourselves to an insured mortgage. But it doesn't mean I think it was necessarily the best idea.
Yeah. This seems all fine. I don't get why they're narrowcasting it so much.
They do say they'll look at it and possibly expand it in the future.
Yeah, ultimately, the amortization limits are kind of arbitrary. There's no real reason why you can't do 30 years just as a general default. Like in the U.S., that's just standard. They have to lock it in for the full term.
Yeah, their mortgages work very different.
Yeah, but the 30 years to pay it off, some people raised concerns about this basically juicing demand, but still a pretty hefty down payment you have to get over, cover off all the costs. It's if you were to bring down the cost of housing, you'd also like generally get the same thing. Helping people, we're not talking about dramatic, like throwing more money at the problem, just changing how people can cover off the cost they're already purchasing, and keep in mind this would raise the total borrowing cost. It all seems fine to me. I'd be fine if they just made it a general 30-year thing for it all.
The other, kind of probably doesn't help a lot of people, but maybe helps a couple people, is they're going to allow people to raid their RRSPs for $60,000 instead of $35,000 for a down payment, assuming you have that much money in it.
Yeah.
And also you do have to pay that back to your RRSP.
Mm-hmm. Over a 15-year period of that, if you add in $25,000 more, that does make that payback a little more challenging.
Yeah. So, whatever. The thing, naturally, I'm getting a bunch of angry emails about from people who don't understand anything is that they also mentioned halal mortgages in the budget, saying that they're going to look at making sure the tax treatment of these types of products is consistent and consumer protections are in place. They don't fully describe what a halal mortgage is, but basically there are some Muslims don't believe because of their religion in paying interest. And so some financial institutions that already exist in Ontario and Alberta have set up mortgage products that charge fees, or the bank owns the house and then you just buy it from them over a fixed period of time. Basically, they take what a mortgage would cost, or a house plus the interest, and then call it something else and charge you that over the time. So they may not be paying the interest, but they're still paying as much as someone with the interest. So to all the people who I got emails from saying, will these be allowed for atheists? Sure, but you're probably going to pay more than you will for a standard mortgage. So
yeah, it's the same thing with just more complications and a new label slapped on it.
Cool. I mean, if the product
Christianity hadn't wisely discarded the prohibitions against charging interest in its doctrine, we would be doing the same thing, because interest is in fact a very important economic function, and just prohibiting it causes a whole bunch of problems, and you need to do weird workarounds like this. Anyway,
it's fine.
You're going to have people do it, might as well standardize the rules so you basically get the equivalent product in regulation as well as in practice from the lender.
Otherwise, in the housing stuff, there's more money for apprenticeships. There's like $1 billion for CMHC to launch a rapid housing stream over the next 5 years. There's another $1 billion over 6 years for the Canada Greener Homes Grants to continue going. Another $1.3 billion over 4 years for the homelessness strategy. Another $1 billion over 3 years for interim housing assistance program for asylum claimants, plus everything that was announced before. So a lot of money on housing programs, in total $8.5 billion. So over, the next 5 years, it is a budget that is trying to do something on housing. And, we've talked about it a lot. The housing people like parts of it. There's always more that could be done. But for, housing not being a federal jurisdiction, they've found as many things they can do, because we need something done. So I'm glad to see them stepping up.
Yeah, it may have taken a pretty bad gaffe in the prime minister to get going on that, but at least it's something. And if it's coming 8 years too late.
Next section of the budget is lifting up every generation. I tried to figure out what this actually was. It's just social programs. Social program spending. They had to lump them all with a theme.
It's no longer the middle class and those seeking to join.
No, I don't know if they even use those phrases in here. They do use middle class a whole bunch.
Oh yeah, so I mean it's a liberal budget. Yeah. Of course,
every Canadian politician is going to use middle class. A lot of this is off the top is just recounting recent announcements.
Only 35 times, huh?
There's $1.5 billion over 5 years to fund the PharmaCare plan. I think that was previously announced. The thing that's really new in here is the Canada Disability Benefit gets funded. And this is something that the Liberals have promised for a while and the NDP has pushed for and has received all-party support in the legislative parliament before. Basically, basic income for people with disabilities. And the idea of the program is to do a top-up benefit that won't replace any of the provincial programs. They haven't guaranteed that yet. because some of the provinces are like, well, if you pay for people with disabilities, we may claw back our benefits, which defeats the point of this. But, you know, people with disabilities tend to live in poverty, and that has become a national shame. So they are investing $6.1 billion over 6 years, with payments to start next July. And the offensive part is that they're going to cap these benefits at $2,400 per year and require everyone to qualify for the disability tax credit certificate, which means you have to have the CRA approve your disability.
Right. So a lot of overhead on that for a whole lot of extra fun. Like an extra $200 a month.
Yeah, $200 a month. But it's means tested. So it's at best $200 a month. Some people, many probably won't even get that. They say about 600,000 people get the disability tax credit, but a lot of, like if you search disability tax credit criticism, you'll find articles over the last 5 years continuously criticizing it for cutting people off, for being too complicated to apply for. You basically need to get the CRA to approve that you have a severe and prolonged impairment in at least one category, or significant limitations in two or more, or receive therapy like twice a week to support a vital function. And the paperwork is complicated. So they are going to fund people to get the paperwork done with $200 million over 6 years. But the initial reaction from all of the people who have followed this file for a while was, oh, yay, money. Oh, that's not enough money at all. That's not what we were promised. Like, this is, I think, a tenth of what the parliamentary budget officer predicted the disability benefit would cost. And so they just went, it's the most like disappointing for a lot of people part of the budget, I think.
Although, like you said, it is intended as a top-up, not as a replacement of provincial funding in its own right on that. And the slightly lower amount than probably ideal is, I think, a little more reasonable if you consider a top-up rather than as, you know, the primary benefit. Although at that point, like, why not just cut out the means testing?
Yeah.
I mean, I can at least see the argument for requiring some form of certification on this.
No one's like, saying you should just be able to like self-identify as disabled and get cash.
And like, I know in the U.S., the number of people on disability claims tends to correlate, correlate opposite to how well the economy's doing. It's like in periods of like prolonged economic downturns. In certain regions, disability claims go up and vice versa. And like when there's recoveries, those claims drop, which like does suggest, at least in the system in the U.S., it's not serving the intended function, and there's probably some fraud going on that. So like a poorly designed system on that front is definitely also a problem that you need to protect against. But yeah, there's probably a better way to do it than having the CRA sign off on it.
Yeah, for reference, like the BC disability benefit is roughly $1,500 for a single adult, but it goes down if you're in a couple. You only get $1,000 if your partner isn't disabled. If you're both disabled, you get $2,500. So it's actually more beneficial for disabled people in BC to be single.
Right. I presume that's basically on the assumption that you would have...
Your partner supports you.
Yeah, your partner's working and it's not the case that you'd be without.
Alberta payments are about $1,700. And, you know, they range across the rest of the country, but...
Right. So,
if you think...
You said 1500 for BC, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is like a 13% increase.
Well, and like if you think back to CERB, when that was launched, it was 2000 a month. So we're still not putting people with disabilities up to CERB levels. So I do like that they talk about how they are going to continue to consult in the spirit, nothing without us, through the regulatory process to make sure this meets what disability advocates have wanted. And I'm sure they'll get an earful. One thing, though, that is very good in this budget that I have only seen positive of is the Canada Learning Bond is going to be automatically applied to every child who would otherwise qualify for it in this country, regardless of if they have an RESP. So this is a program that's existed for a while that gives $2,000 to every child in a family below a certain income level. Usually you have to open an RESP to do that, but generally people only open an RESP if they want to start a savings plan for their kid, and usually you have to have money to do that. So this means possibly 130,000 kids are going to get money they're entitled to go to education, which is a good thing.
It's good. Yeah, lowering the administrative burden on this seems like just a really good idea, too. Also, because this gets started when the kid's four and the withdrawals on an RSP don't come for like 18 years later, you get a pretty big multiplier just from the investment returns on that over nearly two decades. So it's like a really just good ROI on that.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's criticism that can be launched against the RESP top-ups generally, which is more like a good savings plan for upper middle class incomes, but doesn't as easily help people who can't afford to put money away to get it matched by the government. But, you know, the automatic money getting automatically given.
Yeah, the automatic money is good, but good. Also just, yeah, will help you avoid some taxes if you can fund it yourself is also probably pretty good in terms of what the bottom line impact on the government's accounts are going to be.
Indeed. They're also, for students, increasing the Canada Student Grants a bit for a couple more years and putting more money to youth employment, both the Canada Summer Jobs and other programs, and $500 million over 5 years for a youth mental health fund. In this section is also the school lunch program, the childcare expansion that we've previously discussed. And they are now committing the Safe Long-Term Care Act that was part of the NDP Supply and Competence Agreement is coming in, I think, possibly with the budget, or it will be introduced soon. But it's promised here. So that checks off one of the last boxes they hadn't checked. Next section of the budget, noticeably in there, besides the youth mental health stuff, there's not much healthcare spending in this budget. Now, there's been some big healthcare increases in the last few years, but I'm realizing...
Yeah, they just signed big deals with... all the provinces over the last few years on that. Not a surprise.
And there's the PharmaCare stuff, I guess. What as much PharmaCare as
the,
it is.
The, like the tiny, we're going to cover two
the
types
two medicines.
Of medication.
Yeah, the two PharmaCare. Yes. You mean you don't use diabetes medicine or contraceptives? Next section.
Not enough to, make it worthwhile.
Is.
It's very limited in terms of,
The next section is affordability or lowering everyday costs. They talk about a lot in here about grocery costs, but aren't really proposing new measures on that other than a tiny amount of money for a local food infrastructure fund. Mostly it's about how they have been trying to work with grocers to improve competition and get them to sign commitments to lower prices.
Yeah, so basically the same thing where they were finger wagging all through the fall and have like really nothing to show for it.
Yep.
Which also not a surprise because like the primary driver has been global commodity prices and one small country is not going to be able to change global commodity prices no matter how much finger wagging happens.
I mean, there's pretty good analysis that there have been massive dividends and stock buybacks by companies like
Loblaws. There's been some increases in grocery profits, but like it gets swamped compared to like the other drivers of costs.
There's a bunch in this section for farmers. Which kind of ties into food, I guess. One of the big things is they want to make sure farmers can connect their John Deere tractor or New Holland combines. The key thing in here, which actually is a really important idea, is improving interoperability so that equipment isn't tied to the brand. It's the same problem like anyone who's bought Apple products knows this very well. Farm stuff is getting very similar and it's very brutal for people whose like identity is taking these things apart and rebuilding them because they're self-made. I come from a farming family and this is how my like dad approaches tractors, right? But as they've gotten more complicated, it's getting harder and harder to just like fix your own stuff. And so they're doing consultations to at least help with interoperability. And they're also going to be doing consultations on right to repair for not just farm equipment, but basically everything, which will be really good consumer protections to come, but they are in the future, like all of their stuff on junk fees. Although many of the junk fees are provincial jurisdictions, so it's let's encourage provinces to tell Ticketmaster to be better.
Yeah, they can really only do
airline tickets and banks.
Telecoms as well.
Yes. And on airlines, but they are going to require the airlines to be more transparent about the junk fees they're charging you and more clear.
Cool.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. I mean, if they, like that, the telecoms, whatnot, if they really wanted to drive down the cost for Canadians on that, they open up those industries to actual real competition. But there's some previous governments have steadfastly refused to do it. So
or launch nationalized companies to run up to compete. On telecoms, they are looking at a number of fairness moves. They are going to work with companies and amend the Telecom Act to allow users to switch carriers more easily for both your home internet and your cell phones. You'll no longer get charged for switching if you have a vindictive company that's like, oh, all right, you want to quit? That'll be $100. Or it might be a sign-up fee. When your contract is coming up for renewal, the carrier will have to identify plans, including affordable options, and there'll have to be an easy way, possibly like an online portal, for you to just switch or cancel plans so you won't have to sit on hold for an hour and then speak to like salespeople before you can actually cancel. This is stuff that shouldn't require regulation, but they're being bad. So on the banking side,
if there was actual like competition in the market, you would get that. But
although I'm trying to think, when I was in the UK and there was better rates and more competition, I can't remember how easy it was to quit then either. I don't think I did because I had a like £15 a month plan that gave me unlimited everything. Banking, they are going to cap non-sufficient fund fees at $10, just because a number of people who don't have much money are being charged ridiculous amounts, and they're also going to be limiting how many times and how they can charge that. So you can only be charged once every 72 hours instead of like three transactions bouncing in a morning and suddenly you owe $150 on money you don't have. And they're going to work with banks to offer more cheap and free accounts, which is all good. It's not going to like...
Once again, if you actually had like more competition in the market, that would go a long way.
We could also have a competition bureau that didn't approve basically every merger that came to them too.
Yeah, but it's also like really hard to start up a bank. There's pretty significant barriers to entry, both in terms of like assembling the capital and also just getting through the regulatory hurdles.
I mean, somewhat fairly on some of them. It's not a place where we want just like anyone to be able to take anyone else's money.
But we also maybe want a place where you can like have more than five players in the market and new people can actually come together and get stuff going.
Absolutely. So the affordability section doesn't have much spending in it. It's actually only going to cost us about possibly $200 million over the next 5 years. Whereas,
considering where this government is in the polls, I'm surprised they're just like dropping $10 billion to cut everyone a check for, you know, an inflation rebate or something.
Yeah, I forgot to say it was the last section, the lifting up every generation. That's the one that's got a $10 billion price tag over 5 years, and a lot of that is the Canada Disability Benefit and the PharmaCare program, of course.
Yeah, and if you throw housing in there, which gets its own section, the affordability stuff, there's a lot more spending on.
Yep. The next section is economic growth for every generation. I don't think seniors are getting any economic growth in here, nor are infants, but working generations.
Well, the infants will benefit in, you know, the long term on that one.
So what are we doing? We're spending a big amount of money on artificial intelligence. It comes up so many times.
This is high level fine. Yeah, it's an emerging tech area. We should probably be investing in it. Hopefully there will be some downstream productivity gains from it. Overall though, like my general takeaway from this section is it really is, we don't really know what to do with the actual problems of productivity, so we're just gonna throw money at research and hope that helps. But, you know, the fundamental problem in the Canadian economy is we're not actually at the productivity frontier. Other economies are more productive than ours, and just bringing ourselves up to their level is probably not going to be done through cutting-edge research. It's going to be more just unsexy business investment and whatnot. And there's not much in here about just making it much more better to invest in the sort of things that just improve firm-level productivity.
I mean, it's not one of those policies that's easy with just like one, this one trick will make your country productive. It does take...
I mean, there's a few like low-hanging fruit, like getting rid of the final interprovincial trade barriers and stuff, but
I think that got a mention somewhere in this budget.
Another
round of consultations.
They're spending some money on going further beyond the ludicrous that it even needed to happen, Canada Free Trade Agreement.
In terms of what they are spending, so $2 billion over 5 years for an AI Compute Access Fund, an AI Sovereign Compute Strategy, $200 million over 5 years to boost AI startups, $100 million over 5 years for the NRC's AI Assist Program, and then $50 million over 4 years to support workers who are impacted by artificial intelligence. So sorry for stealing all your jobs, creative workers. Here's some, like, pennies to get retrained to find different
work. Learn to weld.
Yeah, right? Until that gets taken over by AI, Scott. There's also $50 million for the AI Safety Institute to study risks and develop policies. Transport Canada is also getting some money to screen all cargo that's bound for Canada using AI. I guess they're already working on a pilot right now, so it's somewhat proved itself. They're going to let businesses over the next 5 years write off the full cost of investment in patents, data network infrastructure, and computers at a cost of $725 million. And they're putting $1.8 billion over 5 years for the tri-councils on research. That's SHRC, NSERC, and CIHR. That's social sciences, natural sciences, and health research. And they're replacing, and they're also building a new, what they call capstone research funding program to umbrella over these and better coordinate between them. And I know they did a big science policy review a few years ago, and there are a number of outstanding recommendations from that. And I think a lot of this science stuff ties back to those recommendations, and like these three institutes are each doing good stuff, but they never talk to each other. And so this is going to help do that. There's a little bit of money to help them harmonize their grant applications, so it's a little bit easier to work out how all of this works, because right now it's quite a mess. And, you know, professors spend a lot of time writing grants when they could be supervising and doing research. So that's positive. A new advisory council on science and innovation. Maybe they'll solve your productivity question, Scott.
I kind of doubt it.
That's not their job.
Like I said, it's like the general problem here is the firm level productivity. Individual companies are not as productive as in peer countries, and are not growing their productivity quick enough. Like, on the thing here that so far we've gone to, that actually probably does the most on that, is the money to write off investment costs on like patents and certain infrastructure stuff. It's probably going to actually do the most on any of this. And even then, that's pretty narrowly targeted.
Yeah. They're spending about $1 billion to increase the scholarships for master's, doctoral students, and postdoctoral students. Although they are actually getting rid of the top, it seems like they're getting rid of the top tier scholarships, the Vanier's and the Bantings. So if you were a Vanier student, you were getting $50,000 a year, but now you're only going to get $40,000. And so for most students, this is a good thing, but it'll kind of remain to be seen how this works out. And they're also increasing the number of scholarships by 1,700. So it's good overall in terms of what people in science have been calling for a long time. We're getting a National Space Council. That's just cool. We're giving an investment tax credit for EV supply chains. So I guess all those big battery plants that got a whole bunch of money are getting an extra tax credit now too.
Because the $13 billion per plant wasn't enough.
And then the best part of the budget, and there's still more to come, but a whole bunch of effort to clarify and reduce timelines for major projects. So a long complaint has been that federal assessments take very long time. And we have a new target of 5 years to complete federal impact assessments. And
it's still a little ridiculous it's going to take that long. I mean, good, they're starting to try and ratchet that down, but 5 years?
It's just 2 years for non-federally designated projects, and it's 3 years for nuclear power projects. There's also a cabinet directive to direct culture change.
The nuclear one's good, but also, like, it's weird. Considering how unreasonably freaked out people get around nuclear, it's weird that one's the one that gets the lowest amount. Well, I guess the non-federally designated, but still, I'm good. It feels a little discordant with some of the other stuff, but I'm all for it. It means for nuclear.
They have also promised to bring in changes to the Impact Assessment Act that were struck down by the Supreme Court of Canada, while still keeping it consistent with UNDRIP. So, in other words,
trying to reduce the amount of target, they also then expanding the amount of stuff they're going to have scope over, which will probably on net increase at that point. Because, like, remember, the part that was struck down was the, hey, we just get to decide that random provincial projects are actually national ones, and we're going to take over or also require our own assessments on that.
TBD.
Yeah, but like if you're going to start, if you're basically going to make changes to allow yourself to insert yourself into other jurisdictions, things to add in more regulatory assignment, you're probably not going to be reducing timelines overall.
If they can do it in a way that clarifies the process, it might be helpful, but I don't have that faith.
Maybe, I mean, have you met this government? They're not exactly good at doing stuff quickly or simply.
Yeah. Speaking of quickly and simply, I'll just burn through the rest of that.
Burn through the rest of that.
Yeah, there's $3 billion for the atomic energy. There's $2.5 billion for carbon rebates for small and mid-sized businesses. And I did want to stop on this one because one of the things they are saying is, you know, we've given the carbon tax rebate to individuals, but we always wanted to give it back to small and mid-sized businesses too. So companies with under 500 employees are going to get a refundable tax credit.
I thought it was 50 employees.
499 or less, because the mid-sized businesses need it too. It's a tax credit based on the number of employees. So 600,000 businesses are going to just get a check because it's a refundable tax credit, not based on how much they spent on the carbon tax.
It's good because that would actually destroy the incentive bit of it, which, I mean, we've already seen the government do that when it came to the Atlantic Canada Home Energy Rebate. I just thought the fuel oil one, that was basically an Atlantic Canada buy-off. But hey, this all seems reasonable. Like, the government likes to talk about how 95% of the money goes back to individuals. This is going to be taking that last 5%.
And giving it to companies who should be cutting emissions anyway.
But like, it's the same thing as individuals. Like, literally the same logic on, you should be changing your decisions to reduce your costs because of the carbon tax. But we're going to offset the short-term pain by just refunding it in a broad-based way that has nothing to do with how much you actually personally consume on it. So it just keeps the incentive, sends the money back to offset the actual costs that are inflicted. It all seems reasonable.
Yeah, but if a company runs out of money, they just shut their doors. If people run out of money, they starve and die. At the worst end.
I mean, shutting the doors also means people lose their jobs and then they run out of money.
Businesses aren't
business
people, though.
Business failures are not costless. And in general, the government shouldn't be in the process of saving businesses from creative destruction and whatnot. But if you're going to put a cost on businesses in the form of a new tax to incentivize behavior, offsetting the pain in a way that preserves the incentive structure actually seems entirely reasonable because, like I said, business failures are costs on both individuals and the economy overall. You just don't want it to create perverse incentives, and there's no perverse incentive.
Or they do it as a non-refundable tax credit and don't just pay businesses that already have a bunch of money to just juice their profits. In any case, let's move on. The federal government has also announced that former governor of the Bank of Canada, Stephen Pelosi, is going to head the working group with Chrystia Freeland and others to look at spending Canadian pension funds on domestic investment. We talked about this in the past, and so it is moving forward.
The corporate welfare with our retirement?
Yes, that one.
That one?
The one we agreed from opposite ends is bad.
We also agreed from the same ends, too. Like, it's just bad all around.
Except when you're in the middle and you're like, what if we did this?
Yeah, if you're a liberal company that can't attract investment
CEO
and want the government to subsidize it, it's great for you. Shitty for everyone else.
They have announced they're going to bring in a right to disconnect for federally regulated workers, and they're going to modernize the Employment Equity Act, which reading it looks like it hasn't been touched since the 80s, so that's probably overdue. Total spending on this section, $7.6 billion. Over 5 years. So another expensive one. Chapter 5, safer, healthier communities. This is a bit of everything. This is kind of climate,
yeah, I think
social stuff, and
criminal
police.
Code changes too, which feels like a weird thing to put in a budget. Like this, yeah, budgets have become a bit of omnibus legislation, but really ought to be the case. I think where, you know, criminal code stuff should get its own criminal code.
Yeah, specifically there's new offenses for auto theft using violence, basically trying to address some of the criticism they had earlier this year for being soft on auto crime, on something neither of us really paid attention to, possibly just like a bunch of stories about auto theft. I don't know.
It's been particularly bad in Ontario and Quebec. I can't see anything here about tracking. Like, the Port of Montreal is apparently like the big place where a lot of the stuff gets exported through, and ports are federal jurisdiction. They could really crack down on that. Yeah, the criminal code stuff's good on its own. They're also amending the Radio Communications Act to ban the devices that basically replicate a key fob to steal a car. Also fine.
Yeah.
Weirdest in the budget. Yeah. Should get its own bill.
It would be an easy to pass bill too.
Yeah, it would be an easy to pass bill. It also like politically get them
more attention.
Hey, we're doing something rather than get it lost in the big budget stuff.
Yeah. Jumping back to the top of this on climate, there's money, $600 million to continue the zero emission vehicle program. Money for parks. We're getting a new National Marine Conservation Area on the central coast of BC. $273 million over 6 years for the action plan on combating hate. The best part in there is how they copy-pasted the sections on addressing the rise in anti-Semitism to addressing the rise in Islamophobia, and just like kept the same dollar amounts of $7.3 million over 6 years for both of these things. Just some goes to the Special Envoy on Preserving Holocaust Remembrance and Combating Anti-Semitism, and some goes to the Special Representative on Combating Islamophobia. But otherwise,
all the rest is like literally word for word.
Wildly the
same.
It
is the most like liberal party thing ever.
You can offend no one by doing the same thing for everyone. Fine. It's fine. There's $42 million just dropped in here for CBC this year. This comes after they laid off a bunch of people, so...
We are so overdue for a proper review of the CBC, its mandate and everything.
Yep.
Yeah. Just laying people off and then throwing money. The whole thing's weird. And, like, nobody... The government has, like, no idea how to actually think about modern communications and cultural stuff. And it's just a mess.
There's also money in here for legal aid. A few hundred million over a few years. There's $30 million for 2 years to do the buyback of assault-style firearms. I guess they're hoping to get that started before the election.
So this is for the firearms they banned in 2020. It's been 4 years now, and they're just kind of getting around to it. Still haven't worked out all the details, and it's ridiculous is the long and the short of it. And yeah, so, this is like a perfect example why I'm always skeptical whenever the federal government's like, hey, we're going to do this big new thing to intervene in some area of provincial jurisdiction. Is they're just not even getting the basics of the things that they're solely responsible, right, and executing on them quickly, and just get good at the basics before you like try and do everything that we already have other governments trying to do stuff. That we already have other governments who are responsible for and who have the expertise in-house on.
They are also putting a little bit of money to make the online harms bill basically happen. There's no new money for judges, but instead what they're doing is redistributing 17 unified family court judges to provincial superior courts by amending the Judges Act, and they're looking at eliminating the residency requirements for federal and tax court judges as a way to, I guess, fill vacancies that they're struggling to fill.
Okay, but why? They've just now added like more judge vacancies they have to fill, because those 17 family court judges are apparently Alberta court judges that the Alberta government has not appointed. But there's already just a massive amount of vacancies that are just in federally appointed judiciary seats. And why does adding 17 more help anything? Well, they already are not doing their basic job of filling these seats. What they really need to do is just do their job and appoint some judges, because like a whole bunch of cases are just getting thrown out, including for some very vile alleged crimes. There's a good piece in The Line that detailed some of that. We'll throw a link in the show notes on that. Or like sexual assault cases are being dropped because they hit the Supreme Court of Canada's 30-month time limit on, including cases where the victims are children. It's terrible. And this is all because the federal government, who is solely responsible for appointing these judges for these particular court cases, just isn't doing their job. Once again, government should figure out how to manage the basis of the things it's responsible for before taking on every other potential problem in the country. Because they're not getting the basics right.
Lots of money here for the last little bit of this section on infrastructure, you know, $500 million for community centers that are green, $460 million over 5 years for Via Rail, including to help replace the Quebec City Windsor fleet, which I had to look up, was built in 1947 to 53, and we acquired it
in the
90s.
Haven't ridden that train. That does not surprise me at all.
Yeah, so congrats.
And keep in mind, this was in like 2008 through 2012.
Yeah, they're still running.
Yeah.
Which is cool, they've only for a museum.
They were old and dingy then.
They bought them in the 90s and they were already 50 years old, 45 years old. They're also giving money to Via Rail to do high-frequency rail between Quebec and Toronto. They're giving money for fisheries and oceans to repair small harbors. So yeah, a few hundred million there. And they're also making ferries in Atlantic Canada free and freezing Confederation Bridge tolls through 2026, because I guess they run those.
Yeah, because they're interprovincial, so yeah. It's federal. Unlike BC Ferries, which is solely...
Vancouver Island should separate, become its own province.
I mean, that would actually lead to cheaper ferry fares.
This section, $6.5 billion over 5 years. Or sorry, $6.3 billion over 5 years. Next section is a fair future for Indigenous people. Given the time, I'm just going to say this is another $9 billion in spending. This is actually pretty substantial.
Covers a lot of it.
You know, direct things the federal government is responsible for and has said a lot of big words. I think this is a pretty impressive section that's worth digging into, but neither of us are great experts on it, so...
We've already done an hour to get to this point, so... Yeah, for the interest of time, it's our editor who let us too much for going over.
Chapter 7, Protecting Canadians and Defending Democracy. So this includes all of the military stuff we talked about last week, I think
last
it was.
Week.
The $8 billion plan for over 5 years. The $73 billion over 20 years. This just... Other money in here for CSIS enhancements, $650 million. Doesn't say what enhancements, because they're the spies. We don't get to know.
Yeah. I mean, we definitely need to be invested in the non-military part of national security as well. So that's good to see. One of the things that came with the public order inquiry from the time the Emergency Act was invoked is that a lot of the CSIS stuff is just, actually from that and some of the other reviews that we've done, not updated to deal with like the modern threat environment, and like we're probably long overdue for a serious when we think of CSIS, what we ask it to do, how it's resourced, and everything. And yeah, throwing $655 million over 8 years at it, an okay start, but we really ought to be doing like a top to bottom review of like the entire national security infrastructure.
There's another $2.4 billion in loans for Ukraine, $2 billion of which was already provided a month ago, $1.6 billion for Ukraine over 5 years for military aid, and $200 million for reconstruction.
I did notice they specify that it's both for lethal and non-lethal military aid, which, I mean, at that point, you've covered all military aid.
They're just
so
being clear.
Why use the verbiage?
They're just being clear and padding their word count.
I guess so, but like, if it was all lethal military aid, that would also be fine, so.
I noticed in here that they're giving basically pennies to veterans, just like a few million for a few programs over 5 years, so it's better than nothing, but it's not much. They're also going to bring in legislation to fulfill a promise to ban forced labor from Canadian supply chains. This has been something that's pretty much all parties have supported for quite a while, because it's hard to justify.
Isn't there a big pro forced labor contingent anywhere?
Some CEOs, not on the record.
I think even that, like, a lot of the problem has been, okay, how do you actually, like, track down your entire supply chain?
Yeah, it's something I think the UK and some other countries are ahead of us on, so...
Yeah, it's tough to do in, like, the fullness, like, just the very complicated global supply chains, but, good goal anyway.
And so another $10.7 billion in spending in this section, most of that being the military. Finally, the taxes, tax fairness for every generation. As mentioned, the big thing here is the capital gains changes, because that's where most of the money to, like, not even to cover this is, but that's where the obvious money is.
It's the big headline tax thing here.
So capital gains inclusion rate. So you sell a bunch of stocks, or you sell your secondary or tertiary property, and you come into a bunch of money off of that. That's capital gains. You are not taxed at that as though it's income. Right now, if you exceed your lifetime exclusion, which is about $1 million, that's going to rise to 1.25. Above that, half of that income counts as gains, counts as income that is taxed at whatever marginal tax rate you're at. For individuals, above your $250,000 annually of capital gains, you'll be now have two-thirds of that included in your income line. So this is not going to affect many people.
Yeah, it doesn't affect many people. Like, one of the main effects of this is to basically bring share buybacks and dividends more in line in terms of their tax treatments for higher income individuals, which, honestly, like, that's a fine goal in and of itself. On net, like, I think there's still some concerns around the fact that businesses aren't doing enough investments in Canada, and that could be an issue. The overall capital stock of the country is not growing anywhere near where it should, and, like, maybe the top level focus should be more on that than changing some of those rules around top end stuff. But, like, the thing on the just making the tax system a little more rational is fine on that front.
Yeah, the big thing
is, like, the overall where the overall focus should be at the moment.
The way they frame it is that the highest income earners get more income actually through capital gains as a percentage of their income than low income earners. So doing this change for individuals helps bring the marginal tax rate for high income earners more in line, because they had actually been using loopholes like this to get out of paying as much taxes. And so fairness is improved across the income spectrum through that change.
Yeah, and also part of the reason why you see a lot of share buybacks happen is because dividends get taxed as normal income, and share buybacks go into capital gains. And I was good piece economist Trevor Toome had in the Hub on kind of why this levels that stuff all out. We'll throw a link in show notes on that as well. So, like, yeah, just leveling those two off so it's equally good to for the company to decide to return profits to shareholders via either of those options seems to make a lot of sense. People get weird about stock buybacks for some reason, even though, like, it is functionally the same as a dividend.
I think it's just become more prominent in the last few years.
Yeah,
it's
people freak out about it, though, and it's weird. And, like, I don't know, you definitely get the vibe reading a lot of commentary on it that people feel that stock buybacks are somehow untoward, dishonest. Like, there's weird vibes people have around it, which are kind of irrational.
I think it's because it is more likely to affect the share price than a dividend.
Yeah, but, like, it.
So
yeah,
it looks like you're
basically capitalizes the. It turns the return into higher share prices rather than dividend payments. But yeah, functionally, it's the same thing of you're returning some portion of the profits back to shareholders,
just
via slightly different method, and mathematically it all works out in the end. That said, leveling the tax system so, like, those get treated the same, there isn't an incentive to do one over the other, is fine.
Notably, the budget also increases the capital gains inclusion rate from half to two-thirds for all gains on corporations. So there isn't that higher cutoff. So this is just increasing the corporate tax rate effectively on the most profitable corporations. So it's hitting about 12 to 13% of corporations, 307,000 they estimate. that claimed capital gains. And that's actually where more money comes from, especially in the first couple of years. Like $10 billion, I think I saw on one chart. So
yeah, anyway, some people are concerned about this stuff. I think a lot of those concerns are overblown. There's that, like, the very high level, you know, you tax something if you want less of it, and yeah, it may have some small impact on that front. Like I said, it covers a very small portion.
CEOs and the most wealthy are upset. Yeah. Most economists are like, yeah, this is fine.
Yeah, it's not going to do much overall. And I think my big concern is less this is going to be directly bad. It's just this is not probably where you want to be focusing your attention on the tax system if the big problem in the Canadian economy is lost decades of productivity growth.
I don't think that's the problem this is trying to solve. This is trying to solve, $20 billion over 5 years, and that's what it generates.
That is my point. It's not the problem they are trying to solve. It's the problem they should be solving, but not the one they're trying to solve. That's my concern here.
To superficially address some of those concerns about investment, they are introducing with this a Canadian Entrepreneurs Initiative, or Canadian Entrepreneurs Incentive, that will reduce the inclusion rate to a third, to a max of $2 million for eligible gains. But the eligibility requirements is basically like, if you sell off the company you founded and ran for 5 years where you were at least a 10% owner, then you can be exempt from, you know, you can claim this lower rate. But it's pretty narrowly tailored.
Yeah, probably more narrow than it should be. I could see a pretty solid argument that, say, early employees who join startups and take a lot of their compensation in potential upside from stock options should maybe have a also get included in this, because in some ways it's not regular income. Yeah, if the company is successful and pays out, it's great. But like, there's a very significant risk associated with all of that, and in the short term, people are often taking lower salaries in exchange for that. And yeah, maybe it's made sense to also include them in this. Because getting those like early people coming in is important. And particularly because I think in a very high cost of living environment, it's harder to convince people to take the risk on that. So upping the upside may be on that good.
They're also still moving forward with automatic tax filing, although this summer they're just rolling out the digital part for low-income Canadians. So someday in the future, you'll have automatic tax filing. There's money to...
terrible if the U.S. beats us to this.
That would be so sad.
They started rolling out their own thing this year. Not. Covers only like 12 states, I think. But there isn't like a low-income only thing. So
like the low-income thing... I get
tax.
Why they're doing that in Canada, because one of the biggest problems of not filing is you don't get the credits you're owed. So by just
sure, yeah. But like also, but, like a lot of people kind of just have T4 income, and yeah, they're not like anyone who just has like T4 income and maybe an RSP deduction or two, both of which get directly reported to the CRA. They have that information on file. Like that should be able to be done automatically for anyone without like a complicated tax profile. It should cover off more than just low-income Canadians and should not be significantly more difficult than low-income Canadian. In fact, it may even be easier.
Other big things in this section, $300 million over 2 years for CRA to improve call center efficiency overdue. $2.9 billion.
Wait time's going to be less than 4 hours?
Maybe, if we're lucky.
4 years, but before I didn't slip on that, but sometimes don't feel off.
Increasing excise taxes on tobacco and vaping, always easy to go after those. $2.9 billion over 5 years to migrate old age security and EI to a new system. Wild amount of money. That's not even juicing those payments. They're changing the Canada Child Benefit, so if your child dies, they don't immediately come after you to stop collecting it, and you'll have 6 months of additional payment, which just... it's not...
seems reasonable.
Yeah, it is a very reasonable thing for someone in that terrible situation.
Also, like, CPP has a death benefit.
That was
like, I'm pretty sure children who have never paid into CPP don't... their estate does not receive that. So, like, just on that front alone, this seems to have, like, equalized things with that kind of equivalent.
They're
and also not traumatizing parents.
Yeah, they're pitching $4 billion over... 4 years in savings by shrinking the public service by 5,000 full-time equivalents.
Attrition mostly.
Yeah, attrition. And they're also requiring public service organizations to cover part of their increased costs through existing resources. So all of this new spending
is like efficiencies.
It's hidden cuts is the secret of this.
A bit, yeah. Although, like, the federal civil service has increased by a lot more than 5,000 full-time equivalencies over the course of this government.
I think a really good article on the public service on how this government is working was Justin Ling's recent interview that was a long form in The Walrus, where it really highlights one of the challenges the bureaucracy has had is just like a lack of direction. So people are just kind of aimlessly mulling and because
having time to work on contracts off the side of their desk.
Well, and so much decision making got centralized that it all got bottlenecked. And a lot of that Ling points is like, I think that's coming down to you, Justin. And he does a good job of like mixing in Trudeau's like soft answers, but then going, that's what he always does is deflect and then move. So I'll link that as well.
The Paul Wells podcast with Justin Ling on this was also good. Since we're plugging it.
Yeah. And then, yeah, more $6.7 billion over 20 years for procurement support on a bunch of things. $700 million over 5 years for immigration, CBSA, and Immigration Board to support asylum system.
They're also going to be putting in or enforcing the rules that require contractors to actually uphold all the requirements of the contracts and put further limitations on what the public sector can do, or public sector workers can do when it comes to contracting, for some reason.
Yeah, so this section actually nets the government an additional $18 billion over 5 years. So it's the first one we really get those gains, but it is the tax one. So overall, that balances you out to negative $40 billion deficit once you include all of the additional spending and or existing spending and revenues. So that's the budget. That took about as long as I expected, actually. It's one I've seen. It's like you've said so many times on this podcast, the government is in a struggling position where what can they do to actually make people happy at this point? And there might not be anything. I'm not saying this is a good budget for that, but it's not bad, actually.
At this point, I think a new leaders might be the only thing that would make them happy. There is no indication that's going to happen. This does feel quasi like a pre-election budget. I do not think that means we're going to have a snap election ahead of time, but it does feel like they're at least trying to put some shots on the net, which at the same time really tells you how terrible they've been as a political operation for the last couple of years, that just like proactively doing some stuff and going out announcing it for a few weeks is seen as some like grand recovery in their political fortunes and abilities.
Yeah, like the big criticism that even liberal supporters could probably bring out here is on the Canada Disability Benefit, or around you didn't talk enough about healthcare, which they have talked about in the last few years, or on climate. But
well, I think the disability benefit probably reaches a small enough segment of the population that it's not going to be the thing that really hangs people up on it too much out of those directly affected.
No, it's not going to change.
I think the housing stuff is probably the major thing here. And that's why it got first billing in there.
And why they teased it for 3 weeks.
Yeah. So like that's the thing that's probably actually going to make a difference. For the most part, the one thing that is missing here is like a direct, this is how we're helping you right now.
I think they tried to do that on the front page of the budget page, like the landing page, where it has like literally how our economic plan can help you buy or rent a home, raise your family, get a job, afford essentials, retire safely and securely. And it just picks out a couple things.
Nobody actually goes to read these budgets except weirdos like us who talk about on podcasts and whatnot. There's no thing that will be in the headlines to take away. That's kind of where I think the political fail on this is. There's no, you're going to be getting an extra $1,000 a month from this, or this will lower how much you're paying for something else. that kind of comes out of it. There's a lot of stuff in here that over 5 to 10 years will could potentially be quite impactful.
Yeah, that's the problem with the housing file is there's no quick solution.
Well, you should have even done something like a renter's rebate or for like a time limited will let you deduct rent and mortgage interest off your income taxes. Just something like that. And I don't think those are great policies of technocratic how you would actually structure things, but as a hey, we're going to save you a bunch of money on like the biggest cost in your life, those would have been, I think, politically potent, and you just don't get.
But if you buy cigarettes, you're going to pay.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Thanks for listening.